Okay, so before we
English.
get back into
I
the to the
English.
deeper theological, I did want to share more of a literary a read just to sort of frame the whole Gemara, because I found it to be a nice little analysis.
What is this?
So this is this book called The Land of Truth is by Jeffrey Rubinstein. Land of Truth, Talmud Tales, Timeless Teachings.
Is it a good book?
So far.
Is it good?
So Jeffrey Rubinstein, if you don't know who he is one of the leading academic scholars of Agadata in the world. He's really very, very, very good. He's li reads it literarily. He's very, very good.
Can I
And he
borrow the
has,
book afterwards?
well,
Can I borrow the book afterwards?
sure. So this is his first
This sounds
non-academic
good.
book. This is his first non-academic book. His first popular book, right? So like it's following the same methodology, but not with the same like it's
Context?
what?
Like the
Right,
context?
it reads more as highlighting the lessons rather as like a academic piece.
What's going through a God? Does he normally go through Agadata and all of this stuff, and just this
No,
one's
he's a
framed?
scholar of Agadata. That's what he
Oh, okay.
does.
So this one is framed more like reader
This is
friendly, I guess.
this is right. This is his first one not meant for academics, correct.
Gotcha.
He has a chapter called Sufferings, Not Them or Not Them and Not Their Reward, being based on our Gemara. Which is obviously one of the least interesting titles, honestly, in the book. Right? The other ones are
The
right the
Dragon.
no. He has The Surreal Sleeper,
Oh,
which is
this is
about Chon
horrible.
Hamagel, What to Do
Oof.
with an Aged and Annoying Mother, which is Garden of Confusion, Forbidden Fruit or How Not to Seduce Your Husband,
What?
Men are from Babylonia, Women are from the Land of Israel.
Hey!
You
That's
know,
bad, though.
he has great
Oh,
titles, great titles for these.
we're from Babel and women are from Israel. Did you
Yeah,
know
Babel was smarter. It's the Gemara.
Anyways,
Also more humble.
okay. Yes, that's clearly what's
You
going on here.
also couldn't
Okay.
make like brothels
Anyways,
in Babel.
he has a
Whatever.
nice read, and just to introduce sort of our Gemara as we get into the Gemara itself. Because what we're going to do now is we're going to try to understand the theology as we started last week. But
Yeah.
before we get back into theology,
Hope your shirt matches your jacket.
what he does, where's Mordechai? Where's Mordechai?
He didn't
Great
do his
question.
Duolingo, so he vanished.
No,
What is
I wanted to make a
Duolingo?
point about Eos, but anyways.
Can you
Also, don't
do
make points
Spanish
about
or
Eos.
Vanish?
Come
Spanish or Vanish? The Duolingo works for
So one of
both.
the things that he notes is that right before we get into the theology, you have to realize that our Gemara, as much as it does have theological elements to it, is just as much about how theology is just not sufficient to understand suffering.
Meaning you need experience.
Right, and I want to share with you just some of what how he reads our Agadata. Right, so he says, right, after going through some of the theology, he says a problem with this theology, apart from it sounding much like a rationalization that defies empirical verification, is that few people relish suffering. To philosophize and theologize in this way is one thing, but when most people experience pain and suffering, they lose interest in ideas. Right? And what he wants to argue is that our Gemara here on Daf Hei, before you even get into the actual theology, is trying to make this point. Right? It's trying to temper the theological discussions with the reality that that's not going to do it for most people.
Meaning, like theology can still be logical. It's just the fact that
Correct,
people don't
but
think like
that's
that.
right, but that's not all, right? When you talk to people, that's not like their first problem is, oh, I have a theological problem.
Like everybody gangster until the Shoah happens, type
Right,
thing.
exactly, right? So he points out, and now here I'm going to read you his translation of Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which is very similar to what we have
Should be
in the Gemara,
way
okay?
gangster.
He says, Rabbi Yochanan became afflicted and endured fevers for 3.5 years. Rabbi Chanina went up to visit him. He said to him, what has come upon you? He said to him, my burden is too great to bear. He said to him, you should not say that. Rather, you should say the faithful God. After some time, Rabbi Chanina became sick. Rabbi Yochanan went up to visit him. He said to him, what has come upon you? He said to him, how difficult are sufferings? He said to him, but how great is their reward? He said to them, I want neither them nor their reward. Right? So what is this Agadata, right? This I think is a very nice framing to our Agadata, right? This Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Because what happens? So Rabbi Yochanan suffers a protracted illness. Rabbi Chanina comes in to console him. Right? And what does he say? Oh, theology, fine. Instead of the Gemara then saying that's not what he does, what does it do? It flips it. And then he says, okay, now Rabbi Chanina is sick. Right? And Rabbi Yochanan came to him, and now what does he expect? Oh, you know all those theological lessons you taught me last time when it was me
What
suffering?
goes around comes
So,
around, buddy.
right? So how are those theological lessons helping you get through this misery. And he says,
you're right.
Right? He says to him, right, welcome suffering for the great opportunity it offers. Rav Chanina's sharp report, I want neither them nor their reward, brilliantly undermines this brighter side of suffering. He will gladly forego these great rewards if only he can be relieved of his pain. In the face of the real, tangible, personal experience of sickness and hardship, Rav Chanina now abandons the very sentiments he had so confidently expressed to his friend. In other words, the storyteller seems to be telling us, you should not think you understand the phenomenon of human suffering such that you can counsel and comfort others until you have been in the same situation yourself. But then you won't be so receptive to the hollow words of your comforters, of outsiders, whole in body and free of pain.
No,
but you shouldn't try with theology necessarily. It's not always the greatest thing. And then he turns to our Gemara, right? And he turns, what? So what's it? So this is Shir Hashirim Rabbah, right? So now he turns to our Gemara on Daf Hey, right? So I will read you his translation because we did this last week, right? So what happened? So Rabbah said, right, what does Rava say in the name of Samzir Chista? That if once he's suffering come upon him, let him examine his deeds. As it says, let us search and examine our ways and turn back to the Lord. Remember that?
Yeah, right.
If he examines his deeds and finds no sins, he'd attribute the suffering to Bittul Torah. Yitlub Bittul Torah, right? If he found no neglect of Torah, he should know that these are sufferings of love, for Yisur and Shalava, right? This we did. Good, now you're here. So I wanted to make a point about Eov, okay? So, right, so then Rava quotes Rav Zara, quoting Rav Huna, and says, he whom the Holy One loves, he crushes with suffering, as it says, but the Lord chose to crush him by disease. Is it possible the Holy One imposes suffering even when it does not accept them with love? No, as it says, if he made a soul an offering of restitution, just as an offering requires consent, so sufferings of love require consent. If he accepts suffering with love, what is reward? He will live a long life, see his offering in addition. His knowledge of Torah will endure, as it says, through him the Lord's purpose will prosper. Right? So this is a little bit past where we got last week in the Gemara, right? Where the Gemara says, okay, if it's not a sin, then it's Bittul Torah. If it's not Bittul Torah, it's Yisurin Shel Ahava. And only if you accept it, Be'ahava. Right? Only if you accept it with love. Okay? Good. So, one second, right? Right, so then he goes through that. Obviously, right, the points the Gemara makes, and these we made last week. Is the first thing you do is try to figure out what you did wrong. If not that, well, Talmud Torah is the most all inclusive mitzvah, and this is the point we made 2 weeks ago. Right, and therefore, you know, you probably violated, right? And therefore, as we said, I think a few weeks ago, he said, given the impossibly high standard, one wonders whether Rava's statement worked better as a motivation to redouble one personal commitment to Torah study than an explanation for suffering. Right? It's possible Rava isn't trying to explain it. Right? He's just saying, listen, use the motivation to get you to learn Torah. Right? That's possible. But then you get to Yisur and Shalava. Right? This is you get to Yisur and Shalava. And again, we're going to come back to the theological point after this. Okay? Now, what is the mashal that Rava invokes? That just like a father rebukes his son, so God rebukes the one he loves. Now, it's not clear. Does he mean in the same way a father disciplines, right? For the same reason, right? But what is this? Again, before we get to theology, emotionally, what does the notion of Yisur and Shalava add to the discussion? Right, exactly. Right? Is that suffering, right, isn't punishment for sin necessarily, right? Right, but God does not cause suffering because he is harsh, mean, or callous, but because God loves humans and wants to teach them the proper behavior, right? Right, and then he quotes this from, right, and then he proves this from several psukim, right? And according to Rashi, as we saw, it means you get extra reward, right? And again, not everyone believes in this, okay?
Assumption that Hashem, like, knows what's in our mind,
for sure. Right? Now, right? Now, some people have he suggests an interesting interpretation of Yisur and Shalava, which is that other sufferers have interpreted the notion of suffering of love in a different way, as expanding the human ability to love. Suffering sometimes functions as a wake-up call, leading to a deeper awareness of our love of others, right? When we're healthy and life seems to stretch out endlessly before us, we're liable to take those we love for granted and not express how much they mean to us. When stricken by illness or staring death in the face, we may feel the urgency to communicate our love openly before it is too late. Okay? Now, what happens after this in the Gemara? So after this in the Gemara then has a story similar to the one in Shir Hashirim Rabba. Right? So what happens after this in the Gemara in Hayom and Bet? And again, for I know you missed the first minute, but we're doing first is trying to do a little bit of an emotional read of the Gemara and then come back to the theological. Right? So what happens after this in the Gemara on Hayom and Bet? Right? So in Hayom and Bet, right, you have to, if you skip a little bit, just like in the piece that he quotes from Shir Shirim Rabba, right? Rabbi Elazar Chalash, right? This is like, it's a bunch of lines down. Yeah. Rabbi Elazar Chalash, Rabbi Elazar got sick. All the Gabar Rabbi Yochanan, came to him, Chazat Dahave Gane Bevet Afel. He sees him in a dark room. Galie Ledare Venafel Nahora. So he revealed his arm and light, right? Right? And the room lit up. Chazi David Kabachi Rabbi Elazar. So he saw Rabbi Elazar crying. Amar Leah, my Kabachi, why are you crying? If it's because you didn't spread enough Torah and enough learn, right? You didn't learn as much Torah as you wanted. We know that the Gemara says, whether you do a lot or a little, as long as you do L'shem Shamayim, it's fine. The like, even, like what? It's like way further on. Yeah, I skipped a bunch.
No, I'm saying like this idea of Echad Amar
Be'Echad. What do you mean?
The idea of Echad Amar Be'Echad.
No, this is a Gemara.
The, it appears like it comes
in multiple places. The Emishu Mizoneh. And if you're worried about your livelihood, local Adam Zoch L'Shtei Shulchan, not everyone gets this world and the next. Okay? Or Torah and wealth. V'imishum bonei, and if it's because you never had children or your children died, that's not a reason to cry. Dein Garma Dasira Abir, look, I carry around the bone of my 10th child. I lost 10. So then, now, I think the average person would have said, you jerk. Okay? Right? And instead he says, no, you're right, that's not why I'm crying. Amar Leila, I shufra de bali ba afra kabachina. I'm crying because you, who are so beautiful, will one day die and decompose in the dirt, and that makes me so sad. Amar Le, al da vade kabachit. He said, that's a great reason to cry. Ubachu travayhu, and they cried together. Okay? Adahachi vahachi, in the meantime, Amar Le, Yochanan said, chaviven alecha yisurin, do you love the suffering? Amar le lo hein velo scharan. He said, not them and not their reward. Amar le havli yadach. So he said, give me your hand. Yav le yada. He gave him his hand ve'ukme, and he stood up. Okay?
So,
yeah, restored him, okay?
Not resuscitated. No
spiritualism
happening
yet? No. So Rubenstein points to this part of the Gemara, right, to highlight the emotional side, right, to the Gemara. Because what happens? Right, let's just try to understand it and then see what it adds to the entire dialogue. Okay, so what happens? Rabbi Yochanan, as he said, reacts like many of us do when someone cries in our presence. What do? We try to halt the weeping by cheering up our friend or providing consolation. Because weeping signifies pain, and we naturally wish to end the hurt, even and perhaps especially if we stand helpless before someone else's physical suffering, right?
Except he didn't because
okay, so what does he do? So what does he tell him?
He says that, like...
So he says, first of all...
You have no reason to cry.
So here Rubenstein says, so first of all, he says, a keen observer of human nature, the rabbis know well that when one is sick and depressed, no matter what the immediate cause, what cannot help but feel other travails more acutely as if they gang up on him, so to speak. He said, Rabbi Yochanan is picking up something very important in the psychology of pain, right? Which is that when people are in pain, often it's not just the current pain that makes them, right, that makes them feel the way they do, right? It brings back memories. It brings back, right? We know that. Trauma, and I'm not just talking about, like, PTSD, right, where we know this, right? That, right, people who are, Right, that's part of the problem, right? People smell the same smells from when they were back in Vietnam, when they were raped, whatever, right? Right, these are right, and they re-experience it. So therefore, right, every future thing is compounded, right? Because there's the moment and there's the right. So that's, but just in general, right? When you are, you know, when people are sick, right? Often it's not just the sickness. It's right. Maybe they have a friend or a relative that they have been in a fight with. Right, but it's more painful, right, when that person can't come and comfort them, right, and then they start regretting, right, in a different way, the way that they're treating their family, their family's treating them, right, or I don't know, someone loses a job, right, and doesn't have the money to, right, is struggling to make ends meet, right, but it used to be when they were younger, they're right, you know. When they would struggle to make ends meet, their parent could bail them out. But now they're, you know, in their 50s, right, and their parents in their 60s, and their parents have passed away, right? So now the fact that they know to bail them out, they feel, right, that loss of that parent, that wealthy uncle, that whatever, right? Meaning, often that's the way things work. So he says, Rabbi Yochanan turns to him and he says, listen, I understand that besides for this current suffering that you have, I get it. I want to know what other experiences are making your current illness so bad emotionally, right? So he says, so what does he do based on that? So what does he say? What's his first suggestion?
Because of the Torah.
Right, that you didn't learn enough Torah. Why? Right, so it could be Olam Haba. It could be that, what is he saying? That often when people feel like their time is near, that's when they regret being not as productive as they would have wanted to, right? Yeah. Then he says poverty. Maybe you're poor. So he says, right, right, that shouldn't bother you. Right now, even childlessness, he says, right? Rabbi Yochanan says, I lost 10 child. What's the big deal, right? Right? I've been in a darker place, and I know, right? Right? I've stopped crying.
It's just so beautiful.
Yes, it's beautiful. But then, what's really odd is that, what does Rabbi Elazar respond?
Oh, yes.
No, you're right. None of that makes me sad. What makes me sad is that you're going to die, and you're just so beautiful. It's like, I'm sorry. Maybe I missed something, this whole experience, what's going on here. That's why you're crying? And the most amazing thing is that Rabbi Yochanan says,
yes, yeah, I'm worried about that too. Right.
Yes, I'm worried about that too.
Oh,
good. So Rubenstein here has what I think is a very nice read. Is that that's not really what he's saying. What is he really saying?
It's the end of a generation.
He said what he's really saying, the real tragedy is human mortality, the inexorable march of time that causes all to age, wither, and die. He says, listen, it's not that. It really is that I'm feeling my mortality, right? I'm sick, and I'm feeling my mortality, right? And it's not just me. It's that I feel my mortality, right? Right, as he says, yes, he tells his friend, all those miseries are terrible. My diseased body is terrible too. But worse is the death that will overtake us, young and old, healthy and sick, beautiful and deformed alike. That indisputable, awful truth, Rabbi Yochanan concedes, provides a just reason to weep. Okay, right. So that's the first thing he says, that when you read the whole Gemara, what are Chazal trying to do? Right, besides for all the theology, which again we're going to come back to, right? Rabbi Yochanan and Elazar's story shows you that Chazal are very sensitive both to like the ideas up there, but they realize that those ideas are embedded in a reality. Right, you can't talk about suffering and these high ideas of. It's about Avera, it's about this type of Avera, Yisur and Shalava, God loves you, that's right. Without realizing, but they're real people. And to talk about suffering and theodicy and divine justice and not recognize that you have to acknowledge the fact that the people to whom these lessons apply are the ones who, when you try to educate them about them, are going to say, right, just spit in your face, right? Like, please shut up, right? Right? I'm saying, those are the cringiest moments I've ever had on Shiva calls, is when I'm sitting there and like, yes, it's like most people who like are experienced know that when you go to a Shiva house, You're supposed to stay silent. If you talk, you wait. You take your cue from the avel, right? You talk about the relative. You talk about how they're feeling. Whatever. You take the cue, right? But there's always that one person who comes. It's okay. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, right? They're in a better place, right? And it's like, oh my God, stop. That's not what they want to hear, right? That's not what they want to stop, right? Like, it's just like, that's, right? There are people who want to hear that, right? But they don't usually, right? I remember being at a horrible funeral, horrible. It was a friend of mine when I was in yeshiva, like a few years older than me. He was in the kollel when I was in yeshiva. And they lost a son, like, I don't know, 3-4 weeks old, something like that. It was horrible. And I remember Rav Aaron gave a eulogy, right? And the eulogy just went. He said, the Torah says that when Aaron lost his children, Vayidom Aaron, right? He was silent. And sometimes there just aren't words. Right? That was it, right? Just sometimes, just don't explain. Don't try to explain, right? Just be there with the person, right? So this Gemara, by throwing this Gemara in Elazar B'Yochanan, it's reminding you that even though, yes, we're going to get to all this theological points, and sin is about, right, sin causes it into sin and that sin, and if it's not sin, it's general Abba and all the theology, and that's all true. But you can't forget that these conversations, especially about suffering, when they take place in real life, they take place in the context of people who are not necessarily ready to hear that, right? They're not ready to hear that. So then Rubenstein says, okay, so then what is the answer? Not necessarily what is the answer. What is the right approach? So he says, okay, well, what's the response? What happens? Look at this story. He cries with, exactly. He says, together, they wept together. Perhaps that is the lesson the storyteller wishes to teach us. No words, however compassionate, no theology, however true, no explanation, however accurate, can really provide solace to the sufferer. So the two sages sit together in silence, in tears, in semi-darkness, knowing that they face life's inescapable travails with friends. It is not good that the human should be alone, preparation. And there is nothing more humane than mortality, decline, and infirmity. No experience more lonely than suffering. Okay. So then I'm going to skip to the next paragraph, right? And then he says, okay, actually, the next point he says, and remember, again, I want to keep reminding you, this Gemara comes at the end of a very detailed theological discussion of suffering. And yet, what is the final discussion? What is, like, the final word on the topic?
Here's what you practically do.
So right before the what you practically do, which is cry, what does Rabbi Lazar say? What is the real reason I'm crying?
Because
I'm going to die, you're going to die, we're all going to die. Right? So he says, yeah, and yes, it's Kohelet, it's Eov, right? And he says, by meditating on death, Rabbi Lazar suggests we learn not to take life for granted, but rather to live life well and meaningfully. That is a much more productive matter to contemplate than the question of why the righteous suffer, which is no satisfactory answer. Right? So he suggests that at some level, this agadata, this ending agadata, might be reminding you that you have to balance speculative philosophy with the reality of what people are ready to hear when they're in the moment. But he says, but it's also possible that's part of the answer, right? Which is, the proper response, even for the sufferer, isn't really speculative philosophy. It's, life is short, so let's live it to the best, right? And now, he says, okay, that's the second to last line. What is the last word on this agadata? Yeah, is, do you want this? Right? Do you want this? And what, right? And what does he say? I don't want his reward, right? So Rabbi Yochanan gets the message. He understands from Rabbi Elazar's arresting reply that neither consolations nor explanations are helpful. Rabbi Elazar, it turns out, like Rabbi Chanina, does not cherish sufferings. He too wants them, neither wants them nor their reward. Thus, somewhat surprisingly, the Talmud gives us a strong protest against advocates of the standard rabbinic theodicy, against those who understand suffering as just punishment for sin, and thereby defend divine goodness in the face of suffering and evil. And the Talmud also seems to protest against sufferings of love, however innovative and provocative the concept, as it too seeks to rationalize the sufferings of the righteous. Do not accept suffering, the storyteller tells us. Neither them nor those who justify them. Neither them nor the routine maxims that explain them. Rabbi Yochanan accordingly switches from theologian to healer and cures his colleague. But how? And what are we to make of the ending? Like many Talmudic sages, Rabbi Yochanan possesses supernatural abilities. In this instance, his arm radiates light, and with a miraculous touch alone, he heals Rabbi Lazar. Alas, we humans today no longer possess such powers. Thus, another gap opens between the storyteller's world and that of the contemporary reader. Perhaps the lesson is that we too must do whatever we can to heal others, if not supernaturally, then naturally. Just as Rabbi Yochanan learns that he must replace theology with empathy and action, so too should we, by dedicating our resources to modern medicine, supporting biomedical research, and participating in clinical drug trials. And although we cannot cure with a miraculous touch, we can provide comfort and solace, visiting the sick, volunteering in hospices, serving as grief counselors, and supporting in other ways.
Sometimes being a logical machine does not help.
Yes! Right. Yes. Yet this distance between us and the sages of old, between our modern scientific worldview and the miraculous and supernatural beliefs of ancient tradition, also points to another dimension of human loss. Not only the ravages of death and suffering inexorable, but also the ravages of time. We are all at a distance from the traditions of the past, at a distance from the pious faith of our ancestors, at a distance from knowing our predecessors and forefathers and foremothers of bygone ages. And for all this, too, we may justly weep. Okay.
Who wrote this book?
What? Yes. No, Jeffrey Rubinson is legitimately one of the best scholars of Agadot on the face of the planet. It's not like an exaggeration. He's very, very good. What? The Land of Truth. And then, and this is for Mordechai, even though this is not our Agadot, this is not on the Agadot, but then he says that with this lesson, right, with this lesson, that as much as it is important, he's saying it's not that it's not important. We're going to come back to it. It is important to think about the theology, right? The Gemara knows to don't think too much of yourselves. Don't be, right? Don't think, oh, I'm going to be an uber rationalist and all that it takes to get through suffering is
the Migdal contrarian
mindset.
Yes, exactly. I know that God is just, right? The whole point in the Gemara is it sets out the theology. But then literally, it tells you this story of people who just cry together, of someone who says, listen, just get me out of this, just heal me, right? And that what they're telling is, I don't want it. Yes, I understand. You certainly ava, da-da-da-da-da. Lohein v'lo schar, I don't want it. But he's saying, that's not where people are, and that's not where you should be when you're coming to comfort people. And that obviously leads us to
Eov.
Because Chazal, very good. Because Chazal, in their example, though not Dvarim, right, the Gemara in the example though not Dvarim. What is the paradigmatic of someone who hurts someone with words? They say Chavirav Shel Eov, the friends of Eov, who these are his great friends, and they come and they sit with him for a few days, and then they say, "You are evil and you're a jerk, and your whole life you told people that God was just, and that if you were suffering the fair, now you can't handle the truth." Right, like what are you crying? Right, like he's like, and he's like, and Eov said, what is wrong with you people? It's like, what is wrong with you? He's like, right, and Eov is like, listen, you want me to take it up with God? Fine. Who exactly is going to issue the subpoena? Right? That's what he says, yeah. Right? He literally says, someone bring him, and what is it? And what's going to happen if we find him guilty in court? Who exactly is going to judge him? Right? He is the judge. He is the jury. He is the executioner. Good luck, right? That's what Eov says. Can you just empathize, you jerks? Right? He's like, in a matter of a day, right? He lost his wealth, he lost his family because of a double dare that the Satan said to God, I double dare you. I was like, I feel like I'm reading a kid's book, you know, like, right? I double dare you. I can show you that he will curse you. I mean, like, what is going on in the book? And his friends, instead of saying, you know, it's really terrible, they said, you hypocrite, you,
like, you kind of deserved it. I mean, like, I don't know. But
right, exactly.
Look, I know that you're in mourning, and it's been, like, 7 days since, like, all your kids have died, and you came down with this terrible sickness, but...
right. So...
So...
So that's really the question. Is obviously it's important because, listen, it's often thinking about these things, especially when it's not happening to you yet, is important. It helps you frame your life. It's not that it doesn't help. It's just that sometimes you don't think about it the day of, right? Right? It could be that after you lose a relative, right? This is often how people do things, right? Is at Shiva, right? At the funeral at Shiva, what are they doing? They're crying, they're remembering their relative, right? And then what do they do a week or two later? And that's when they start to process and say, you know, my father really stood for this. My mother really stood for this. You know, maybe I could, right? I could really bring that into my life, right? Right? That's when they start to process and they start to think and they start to think practically, right? There's a time and place. It's not that theological thinking about it. It's not that using suffering as an impetus for tshuva, for building. It's not that it doesn't happen. It just doesn't usually happen, you know, at the funeral. It doesn't happen to Shiva, right? But you think about the people that, but it happens, right? There are very few people who, in the midst of tragedy, manage to just exude, like, a calming theological. There are people, okay? I don't think anybody, I'm a little bit older than you, right? But, and I was in Israel, you know, I'm a little bit older, right? What? I'm like 15 years older than you, right? But you're still probably old enough to remember this. But it was a few years ago, right? It was like seven years ago, God, right? What? So if you remember when the three boys were, yeah, were kidnapped, oh, yeah, 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 right? So I was at the funeral. It was right here, Modian.
Oh, wow.
Right outside Modian.
Wait, was he from Modian?
One of them was from, not from here, from Nafayel.
Oh, right.
Right.
How old are they?
What?
260 to 119.
They were high school. Or high school. Wow. I know, it was horrible. I mean, look, you have to remember that for me, they were kidnapped about 500 feet from where I was, right? Because, right, it was right outside Yeshiva, it was right outside of Gush, right? Because they were coming from high school, right, which was in Kfar Tzion, which is the next Yeshiva over. And they were kidnapped at the bus stop, which was right outside of Lon Shvut. So, right, which meant it was very immediate. A lot of people I'd known since they were little kids, right? Like some of my Rebbeims, right? I was back in the Kollel. So, like, right, Tarragon's kids, who I knew when they were, like, my kids' age, right? Like when I was in Shana Aleph, they were my kids' age. They were six and eight, right? They were now high schoolers and now we're in their class. So I'm watching these kids I've known, they were little kids who are now high schoolers who are just crying in the streets, right? In Alon Shvut. And then I went to the funeral. It was horrible. It was horrible. It was you know, heart-wrenching, right? You can't imagine. It was crazy, right? We were stuffed. I mean, it was tens of thousands of people, right? On the up, you know, I don't know if you know where the cemetery is, like up the hill, right? Like you can't even, it was 105 degrees. Like you couldn't park anywhere near it. Like they made you park kilometers away. We're all walking in the heat, like thousands and thousands of people. I mean, we were stuffed together. People were crying. It was like, it was horrible. I've never seen, like it was everything about the day was horrible. I remember standing there and like people were so close together that I saw a louse crawl out of somebody's hair and jump into somebody else's hair. I mean, like, that's how, God, it was really, it was bad, right? Right? But, right, I don't think anybody who was, like, especially people here then, but pretty much anybody forgets listening or seeing Racheli Frankel, right, throughout the whole thing, right, the mother of, right, one of the mothers. I don't think anybody forget, because she just always, every time you saw her talk, every time you saw her, right, had this, like, you know, like, even when she was crying, it was like this calming presence. She always spoke. I mean, she happens to be a very inspirational person in general, right? A very serious Talmidei Chachama, right? She's a very serious Talmidei Chachama, right? She's a good speaker. She's a very, like, you know, and, like, somehow she had this, like, you know, even when she was crying, there's like calm, there's like faith that she would talk about every time. But most people can't do that, right? Right? There was a reason I remember people talking about how, like, you know, it was, like, everyone was there, right? You know, chief rabbis were there and, like, you know, and she got up and said Kaddish, right, at the funeral. And people were talking about it, like, you know, even people who are not, like, comfortable in general, like, No one said anything. Like, there was, you know, it was like, it was so clear. Like, if, you know, this person wants to say Kaddish, right? Even if that's not your halachic ideal, right? No one said anything, right? Because certain people just, like, threw out, like, you felt like they managed to have, like, a perspective. But when you listen to an interview with her, right, and she's getting many over the years, right? She said, she always says she was surprised by that at some level, right? That people saw it that way, because that's not how she felt, right? It's not how she felt, right? She felt like in chaos, right? She felt like a world, right? You know, she didn't feel like she was exuding faith, right? So there are very few people who can convey that, and even the people who do, you don't know if that's how they're feeling, right? That doesn't mean that a few weeks later that there isn't value to thinking, now, how do I grow from this, right? To thinking, it's just not necessarily what you're supposed to do in the moment, right? It is one of those very interesting things in Israel. It's very tragic, but often you can tell the generation of people in Israel, and especially of Olim, right, by, like, what is the defining, like, attack or war, right, in their life, right? It's often, like, that first, right, that first attack, right, meaning, and that was, like, right, that was, like, when I, you know, I was around for a lot of these at different points, right? But that was, like, the one when I had already made Aliyah, right? And that was, like, you know, it's coupled with the fact that it was followed by rockets. And, like, you know, even though we didn't have so many, right? The few times we did have sirens in Alon Shvut, right? Alon Shvut didn't have many. But still, I lived on the top floor. And, I had a baby. I had Meir. And, like, to run down six floors to the bomb shelter with a baby, right? Without shoes, right? In the middle of, like, a Shabbos meal, right? Like, you know, the whole, you're on, you know. I'm saying, right, you don't feel comfortable taking a shower, because what if it goes off when you're in the shower? What are you gonna, you know, like it's a very disconcerting, the whole thing's disconcerting, right? So everything mixes together, right? And these come to define your experience. Well, but remember, the apartment building was a communal one, right? It was a communal one for the whole building, right? In my house, I don't care, right? I have a bomb shelter in my house, I don't care, right? I was living in the Kolo apartment, right? So coming now to Eov, where he says what Eov is really presenting is that the simple pshat of Eov, if you read the first parak, is what? What's his theology? That the righteous can and do suffer. Right? If nothing else, the fact that the Satan double dares God and that's why he suffers tells you that the simple pshat in Eov is that the righteous do suffer. Right? It's not always fair. Now, you want to justify it theologically? We can do that.
Also if Eov didn't deserve it or not is up to his faith.
Okay. Right? But now he says, but what's the point? He says, if the simple shot of the book is that good people can suffer, then to accuse the righteous of sin adds insult to injury. Right? Remember, the theological explanations only work if you think that whenever someone suffers, there's always an explanation. But the second you think there's any explanation that is more random, then to automatically say, if you're suffering, then X, right, is... Right, exactly. But, and especially if it's wrong, right? Meaning, if it was right, then it's bad because people aren't ready to accept it. Kal vachomer, if it's not right, right, to come and say, oh, you're suffering, you're crying.
You clearly deserve
to have all your kids die, right? That's worse if it's not true, right? That's not Yisurin. What do you?
Yisurin is like when you take out the wrong number of money, not when your entire family dies.
That's Yisurin. What are you talking about? The Gemara's example. Then Garma the Zira Bear is loss of children is also Yisurin. The Gemara's point is that even little suffering is suffering, but Kavachomer, big suffering is suffering. Right? For sure it is.
Big suffering will probably be even if small suffering could be out of love, doesn't mean that big suffering is.
Right? And what is the message then of the book? So as we'll get to the end, how does God answer the problem? Right? So, but you'll see at the end, God confronts Job with a relentless series of rhetorical questions emphasizing God's colossal power and the unbridgeable gap between the divine and the human. And then he goes on, right? The questions carry on. In other words, Job cannot and should not expect to understand the ways of God, whose power far exceeds human comprehension. In the face of this divine onslaught, Job concedes as much, admitting his infinitesimal stature vis-a-vis God and abandoning the search for an explanation of his sufferings. God also castigates Job's friends for their false claims about God's methods, namely the notion that God justly punishes the sinful and rewards the righteous. God is unknowable, and how dare they have the audacity to assert why God does what he does.
Which one clearly said it at the beginning of the book.
Exactly. Okay. So now I'll just read you his conclusion. So what does he get from both of these, right? From the fact that the Gemara, even though it does provide a theology, in the end ends with a more emotional thing, which is just cry with me, right? And get me out of this. And Eov, where God's fundamental insight is, you can't understand and you guys shut up, right? The three of you shut up, right? Your friend is suffering. Just be quiet, right? So what he concludes with is a well-functioning religion or theology does not necessarily explain the meaning, the problem of suffering, but helps make that suffering meaningful. The author of Job would likely hold that suffering has meaning, even if that meaning is incomprehensible to us humans. Even if this theology of the book of Job may strike us as unsatisfying, paradoxically, it has a certain appeal in its negation of explanations that attempt to make sense of suffering, especially those that associate suffering with sin. For example, contemporary theologians have almost unanimously resisted explaining the suffering of the Holocaust along the lines of the standard covenant theology. A theology that rejects the possibility of comprehending such colossal suffering may be somewhat more appropriate, even if not completely adequate. On a personal level, too, some people may prefer to leave the cause of their own suffering as mysterious and inscrutable while holding on to belief in a God who governs the cosmos. The great Hasidic master, Bleva Yitzchak of Berdichev, prayed, "Master of the universe, I do not ask you to reveal to me the mysteries of your ways. I could not understand them. I do not even want to know why I suffer, but I do want to know that I suffer for your sake." So the first half of, you know, today's shiur, I wanted, right, again, Rubenstein is really an excellent analyst of Agadah, but the first point I want to make is that whatever theology you get from it, right, the Gemara is in many ways subverting itself, right, by telling you, yeah, there might be a theology, right, it might be coherent, right, you may not understand it, which is the machloket that we saw last week in Dav Zion, right, the machloket, whether even Moshe ever really understood it. But whether you understand it, it's possible to understand or not, you've got to realize that theology is only half the discussion, right? Most people, that's not what they want to hear. They can't hear it. And you have to acknowledge that when you're talking about suffering, right? The human element cannot escape you when you're talking about the theology because you're missing something important then. Okay, so that's the first half, is the limits of theology. Okay, that's the limits of theology. But now let's turn back, because the Gemara, despite the limits of the theology the Gemara ends with, what is the rest of the Gemara about? The theology, right? Which is, that's how it started, right? Was, if you, right, remember, right? How does the Gemara start? If you suffer, so figure out what sin it is. If it's not sin, then it's Yisur, then it's Bittul Dor. And if it's not that, it's Yisur and Shalava, right? So the Gemara is trying to to present a theology. Now, what is the theology? Okay, so here I want to really share some ideas from Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Ellman. I'm in a really excellent piece. Obviously, I'm not going to read the whole thing for you. He's written many, many articles on it, but this one is the one in this book. In general, if you want a lot on Jewish theology and suffering in a very sort of accessible way, this is the Orthodox Forum. So if you know the Orthodox Forum was it's something that ran at YU for many, many years. It basically would bring together thinkers from across the board, rabbis, theologians, philosophers, historians, sociologists, psychologists, to deal with a host of different issues. And they would have conversations and they'd write up a paper and write a book that was meant to be somewhat, somewhat sort of like an educated laity, but to try to address a problem from many different angles, right? So they have... this is one of the earlier ones. But so, for example, they had rabbinic authority and personal autonomy, Jewish tradition and the non-traditional Jew, which I think might – I know Moshe is borrowing one of mine from Israel is a religious reality, modern scholarship in the study of Torah, Tikkun Olam, engaging modernity. The most recent one that's coming out as a book was on Neo Chassidut, which was edited by my old chavrusa, the same one who went to your shul. what? Okay. He's wonderful.
Yeah, it's almost like a Reformation movement of
the two. Yeah, for sure. So this one is a pretty old one. It's from 1999. Jewish Perspectives on the Experience of Suffering. Okay? So there's really a lot of excellent material here. If this topic really speaks to you, so this particular volume has a very helpful thing at the end from Rabbi Yitzi Blau, which is an annotated bibliography on the problem of evil. It's 15 pages of a bibliography on Jewish and secular books that he suggests that you read if you want to understand it. Yes, you can see it's a bibliography that it's not meant to be comprehensive, but you can see it's 15 pages of a bibliography.
Not meant to be comprehensive, but also 15 pages of a bibliography.
Correct.
Are you going to get any of your old covers?
You should.
I'd love to. Awesome. I mean, most of them don't live here.
Your old covers are like all just like.
But I mean, Shlomo was my covers for a very long time.
Shlomo Mela?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Someone's like, here. We were covers for a very long time. Covers is on and off for 5 years. So one of the articles here is by Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Elman, who was a fascinating person. Fascinating.
I saw his name in some of the tradition.
Yes. So he was a very interesting person. He has a very interesting life. He was in Chaim Berlin for like 15 years. And then he did a bunch of very unrelated professions. He was a meteorologist for a bit. He owned a Sfarim store for a while. And then when he was on the Lower East Side and when he opened the Sfarim store, academics from NYU would come and schmooze with him and convinced him he should go into academia. So then he went. He got 90% of the way through a PhD in Parshanut, mostly writing, but either the Ramban or the 19th century omnisignificant thinkers. And then before he finished that, he decided to switch and basically invented a new field of comparative study of Iranian Judaica, of comparing the Talmud to as understood in the theologically from the vantage point of people writing within the Sasanian Empire, and basically created this field. So he split his time between YU and Harvard. But his other scholarly works was like he was obsessed with the Tzaddok. And he would like give shiurim on how he viewed himself as sort of a Gilgul of Rav Tzaddok, who in turn he thought was a Gilgul of the Ramban, who he thought was a Gilgul of Rava. It was very interesting. Like, he was a very interesting person. I don't know, Gilgul, whatever. The intellectual heir, fascinating person, brilliant, really brilliant. So he wrote a series of very helpful articles on it. So that's chapter 5 here, the contribution of rabbinic thought to a theology of misfortune. And the main point I want you to get out, I'll give you in a nutshell, is that many of the Rishonim are convinced that in the end of the day, suffering, all suffering happens for a reason. Right? And that's why they push back, right? They really push back on things like Yisur and Shalafa, right? And things like Yisur and Shalafa. Because Yisur and Shalafa at first glance really sounds like, well, I didn't deserve it, but, right? So some will say, oh, you did deserve it, but for lesser sins, so God is helping you cleanse your soul or whatever, right? But many of the Rishonim really are uncomfortable with the idea that ever, that there's something which is fundamentally not just.
Aren't all challenges just the definition?
Depends, right? But his main point is that if you're fair with Chazal, right? If you're fair with Chazal, now again, Elman was very insistent. You have to remember, Chazal is not one person, right? Meaning there can be machlokot where you will see that different voices throughout Shas, throughout the rabbinic writings in general, Midrash and Bavli and Yerushalmi, etc. It could be they don't agree. But what he points out very simply is that there's a lot of evidence that there were at least some, and this might even be the dominant voice, but definitely many voices in Chazal, who if you read them, pshutam kimashma'am, without walking in the assumption that everything is really just in the sense that it's reward and punishment and things like that, you could easily see a theology that just doesn't believe that. Right? That just doesn't believe it. What? Oh, an example. What is one example?
Wrong question, Josh.
What are all of the examples in all of
the... That's exactly what he will tell you. Now, you got to understand, Elman, when he was... I didn't actually take him for this class, but one of my other chavrusas did. He said his rule at the beginning of the semester was, if you can ever catch me in a mistake... Yes, if you ever catch me in a mistake in a Gemara, you get an automatic A for the semester, right? Right, like he knew Shas backwards, forwards by heart. I mean, like this was not someone who you could say, "Oh, give me an example." Like, no, he's Hasidish, like Yeshivish Hasidish, like Brooklyn, like not Hasidish Hasidish, like you know, lived like Flatbush, like Flatbush. He's lived in Flatbush, you know. He was like a Brooklyn Jew, you know.
Except that he was like an Uber genius.
Yeah. Mordechai's just being humble, you know.
Does he go through Yerushalmi too, Rebbe?
What?
Does he go through Yerushalmi too?
Yes, and he notes that Yerushalmi might be different than Bavli on this. So here, let me give you so this is what I want to do, is just give you some of his evidence. So what are some of his pieces of evidence? Okay, so. First piece we actually saw last week, which was Shabbat Nun Hei, right? Shabbat Nun Hei. That it's not clear, Lamaskana, right? The Gemara makes it clear that death, in simple pshat, death can happen without sin, right? But the Gemara doesn't actually conclude firmly that you can't have suffering without it. Right?
And it says it does.
No, so we had, remember, we saw.
Well, parts of the pshat says
no, but remember, we saw that the Rishonim aren't sure.
Yeah.
Right? The Rishonim.
No,
shown him.
But you said. He's going
to shoot the... Well, a second, right? But in the Gemara, it doesn't actually, right, say it. Now, he says, he does think that in the Yerushalmi and the other Eretz Yisrael sources, like Midrash Rabbah, they are less inclined to admit that the righteous suffer, except in extraordinary circumstances. However, he thinks, at least in the Bavli is much more comfortable. So now I'm going to give you a bunch of examples very quickly, okay? And some of them are from Brachot, so you should recognize them, okay? He said the merit they accrue, which should protect them against life's vicissitudes, does not influence significant aspects of their lives. These include three factors that make up the greater part of the human condition: length of life, viable offspring, will survive the parents, and sustenance. Okay, so now let's get some examples. Let's stick with simple pshat of the Gemara. We're doing a Gadata. Okay, here's one from.
Brachos.
From Brachot, what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that there is a time at which, if you channel,
you can punch them.
Oh, very good. The Gemara says if Balak had managed to capture Idan Ritka, the moment when God was angry, he would destroy the Jewish people. Wait, I'm sorry. What is the Gemara saying? Bilam. Sorry, Bilam. Right. What is the Gemara saying there? What's the Gemara saying there? Does that, simple pshat, does that mean that everything is fair? If he got the right moment, then he could have destroyed the Jewish people. So God made himself not angry. I don't understand. If everything is just, so what does it matter? It's simple pshat of the Gemara is that, right? No, again, his point is that if you read, there's so many pieces of evidence, right? Now, Yisur and Shalava, again, if you don't know what Yisur and Shalava is, simple pshat is, did you deserve it? No, right? You didn't deserve it. It might be that God will make it up to you, right? That's how Rashi understands it, right? Rashi understands God will make it up to you, but not that you deserved it, right? What about vicarious atonement, right? When the Gemara talks about the possibility that you're punished for and this is implicit in certain psukim, that you're punished because of what your ancestors did. Right?
Not that, though.
Sometimes it says it does, sometimes it says it doesn't. No, right? No, again, his point is that there's a... Again, he's not saying this is unanimous. He's saying there are a lot of Gemaras that you point to them that will show you that not every voice in Chazal is committed to the notion that every suffering can be justified. That's what he's saying. Correct, but fine, but still... Right? Right?
As an extension of his father, he's not necessarily
just,
I don't know.
Yeah, but Rebbe, doesn't that say that if you don't fall in the ways of the Gemara, you don't get...
What I don't understand...
Yes, that's what the Gemara says.
Right, so then
is the midrash of God being angry that one
or
moment?
Or two different voices. Hashem Pshat is two different
characters. No, again, they're different. And they, right?
What's the explanation for God being angry?
Then he notes that in several places the Gemara, right, several places the Gemara talks about how people need to die so that people will be able to become leaders because, right, yeah.
What's the thing about God being angry that one time? The last time I remember hearing about that was in Rome, which says when I read it when I was...
No, but it was earlier in the Gemara, right? Gods.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, aside for that, but like, what's up with that? That's,
right?
That's
any, but let me read you some more, okay? Here. Here's the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Chavchet. Now I'll read you the English. Rava said, length of life, children, and sustenance depend not on merit, but on mazal. For take Rabba and Rav Chisda. Both were absolutely righteous rabbis. One master prayed for rain and it came. The other master prayed for rain and it came. Rav Chisda lived to the age of 92. Rabba only lived to the age of 40. In Rav Chisda's house, 60 marriage feasts and Rabba's 60 bereavements. At Rav Chisda's house, there was the purest wheat bread for dogs and it went to waste. At Rabba's house, there was barley bread for humans and that could not be found. This too, Rabba said, I've requested three things for heaven. Two were given to me, but the third was not. The scholarship of Rav Chisda, the wealth of Rav Chisda were given to me, but the modesty of Rav Huna was not given to me. Right? What's the simple shot of the Gemara? Here's two equal people who have the same, right, life, and one suffers, one's out, one's poor, one's rich, right? And it's Talui bin Mazal. Right, so now you'll tell me, oh, mazal, what does that mean? But the point is, simple pshat, the Gemara goes out of its way, according to at least Rava, to tell you that you could have two equal people, right? And one is a good life, and one is a bad life. Right? Now, again, you could come up with terutzim. Maybe one daven, maybe one didn't, maybe one this, right? But in the end of the day, the simple pshat is, right? Is that not everything going to be explained? And then he notes, what about the Gemara we just read? Right? At the end of our Gemara. Right? The story of Elazar and Rabbi Yochanan. Right? When you read that Gemara, right? When you read that Gemara, how do you read that Gemara? Right? What does he say? Why are you crying? You didn't have enough money? Not everyone can. Some people can, some people can't. Some people can have Torah and wealth, some people can't. Right? Right? Some people lose children, some people don't. Right? You lost your children, sad? I did too. Right? But he doesn't say, right? That's what he's, right? So we noted from Rubenstein that maybe what the Gemara there is saying, there's a limit to theology. And maybe that's part of the lesson. But part of the lesson might be also, listen, things are unfair. You're right. Right? You're right. Meaning the fact that the Gemara, in the middle of a theological discussion, throws in a story where the basic lesson is, look, not everything's fair, and sometimes you just have to deal with that. Right? And you have to learn how to be there for people. Right? That, right now, of course, we already saw Shabbat Nun Hei, right, with the whole question of death, and did our Moshe and our own sins considered sins? Etc. right now, he also note Okay, I'll give you a few more examples. I'm just going to sort of skim through. Right now, he does in Kedarko Bakodesh try to figure out who in the Gemara might hold what, right, and distinguish between Rava. Okay. Another Gemara. Kiddushin Lamed Tet Amud Bet. What does the Gemara in Kiddushin Lamed Tet Amud Bet say? So the Gemara in Kiddushin Lamed Tet Amud Bet talks about what do mitzvot protect you or not? Okay? So you have the position of Rabbi Nachum ben Rabbi Yossi, who says that doing mitzvot only protects you while you're doing the mitzvot, while Torah can protect you more. Right? And Rabbi Yossi, right? Right?
Aren't there those mitzvot that you do and affect you in real life? Like,
right? But what? So, and that's, but in that same sugya, you have the position of Rabbi Yaakov, who says that mitzvot in this world have no schar. So he says, well, look at that, right? You have one sheet who says mitzvot in this world have no schar. What does that mean? You don't get the schar for mitzvah in this world. That means it doesn't protect you, which means that you could be righteous and you might still suffer because the reward's in the world to come. But that means that what's happening in this world might not be fair, right? And then you have the people saying, no, it does protect you. But even when they say it protects you, does it protect you fully? What? It doesn't, right? And he says, okay, fine, but the point is that means that not everything in this world, like, it's not always going to be. The good, right? Good things happen to you, even though you're a good person, because it's fair. But the point is, right? But he said, right, and he says the fact that when you say, oh, Torah and mitzvah, they protect you while you're performing the mitzvah, but not afterwards, right?
Better not stop doing mitzvah.
Right, but exactly. But what if I go to sleep, right? Or what if I, right? Or like that Agadata with David HaMelech, right? He couldn't die. The Malach couldn't get to him until he distracted him from Talmud Torah, right? I mean, that's fair, right? Like, yes, exactly. But then he notes, so for example, right, you have a whole series of Gemara in Bava Kamma, right? Where the Gemara comes up with this idea of all the things of, let me read you a few lines of it. One second. Okay, this was a Gemara that was quoted a lot during COVID. Okay. You might have heard this, right? What does the Gemara say you should do when there's plague? Very good. Tana Rabbanan. Dever ba'ir. If there is a plague in the city, kanes raglecha. Pull in your feet, right? Meaning, go inside. Shneimar v'atem lo tetzu ish mipedach beito ad boker. As it says, don't, right, by Pesach Mitzrayim, don't go outside till morning. V'omer lecha mibaba chadarecha, skor delecha ba'adecha. And Yeshayahu says, go shut your doors behind you until ad yavor za'am. Right, until the anger leaves. And it says in Dvarim that the sword will bereave outside the chamber of terror. So what does this mean? You might think this is only at night, but during the day not. Tashma, go close your doors. And you might say maybe you only stay inside if it's not bad inside, right? But if there's fear and stress inside, so then it's better go take a walk, right? And then you might say it's better to go amongst other people. Tashma, no, it's better to stay inside, because inside there's fear, but outside there's the sword. Even though inside it's scary, outside there are swords. Rava says, Be'edan Ritcha, when there was a plague or there was anger, Heve Sachar Kave, he would close the windows. Why? Dichtiv, ki ala mavet b'chalonenu, death is coming to our windows. What does the Gemara say? Does the Gemara say, if you're a tzaddik, you'll be saved? What does it say? There's a plague, lock your door, put yourself in isolation, quarantine, yalla. right?
You could just say that because you don't know whether or not you're going to be saved.
You could say a lot of things, right? You could say a lot of things. Yeah. But the point is that when you put this all together, and by the way, President Elman loved doing this, was the fact that so far several of these Gemarot, which you could say, well, you could say, but who was the author of half these Gemarot? Rava, right? Rava consistently is the one who says things like that,
or
he's right?
Very metaphorical.
Whatever it is, right? But the point is that you go through all this Gemara, and this Gemara, the Gemara's, right? The Gemara's advice is not, as he said, it's not bad advice, but it's, as he says, Rava, he said, the sugya contains advice attributed to Rava to close one's windows in times of plague. Not bad advice at all, but not quite in the same category as fasting, prayer, donating to charity, etc. And therefore, this is Elman's summary. He says, I suggest, therefore, that Rava, or more precisely, his view stands behind the sugya and Shabbat. But hey, this does not mean that Rava rejects a measure-for-measure understanding of divine governance. That's hardly possible for a Jewish thinker. He's not saying that things aren't fair in the large, right, yeah, picture. Moreover, we have evidence that he himself applied the principle. See Shabbat Lamed Bet, where he applies it to the women of Machoza, who do no work and thus bring on locusts and famine, or Avodah Zarah Yud-Chet Amud Bet, where he begs his students to avoid frivolity so as to not be made to undergo suffering. Right? The principle would seem to operate on the communal level always, and sometimes the individual level. It's Rava, according to another tradition, Rav Chisda, who was, after all, his father-in-law, suggests that, and this is a Gemara in Brachot Daf, hey, right? That when a person sees afflictions coming upon him, he should examine his deeds. If he does not find a reason for the afflictions, he should attribute them to the sin of Bittul Torah. And if he does not find the sin of Bittul Torah, he should classify them as chastisement of love. Here, Rava carefully coordinates both forms of misfortune, that based on the measure-for-measure principle, and that which goes beyond it. Right? Yisurin Shalava, chastisement of love, which God brings on the righteous for no other reason to increase their reward in the world to come, are a confirmation of merit rather than of the reverse. But they're certainly not an example of measure for measure. Finally, we have a small collection of Memra in Chulin Zayin Amud Bet, where once again, Rava severely limits the operation of divine providence. Again, Chanina said, no one bruises his finger below unless it is so decreed against him above. Rabbi Lazar said, the blood of a bruise atones as is the blood of a burnt offering. And what does Rava say? Only the blood of a second bruising of the right thumb, and only if it happened to one who was about to perform a mitzvah. Rava here seems to limit providential atoning suffering to those injured while engaging in performing a mitzvah, and only in strictly delimited circumstances. If Rava's comment relates only to number two, other bruising must be attributed to causes other than the need for atonement, namely, but not exclusively, Surin Shalafa. If his comments relate to number one as well, he denies even providential status to most bruises, perhaps relegating them to situations of Kviya Hezeka, which is another category, right, that you have to be careful when things are dangerous, or plain carelessness. In any case, Rava's limitation of providential suffering is clear, no matter what category most bruisings are assigned. Thus, for Rava, a confluence of natural factors, astrology, divine judgment, determine man's place in the world, while reward is deferred for most until the future, for a future world.
Rabbi, do you know of anything bad that could have happened in Rava's life that would have caused him to take this view? I couldn't figure it out.
So you can go through here, right? What I don't know, in his life. So basically what he, right, so his summary is that if you go through it, again, he says the simple pshat, and it's not that we should try to deny this, but again, he wants, right, Elman wants you to be open to the possibility that there are at least voices in Chazal that are not like the Rambam, basically. Right, and therefore he says, this is section 7, he says, the Bavli thus provides us with a number of mechanisms of divine governance that in their simple sense violate Maimonides' strict canons of divine justice. These include the astrological sources of the human condition, sufferings of love, nisayon, vicarious atonement, situations of negligence in the face of hazard, right? There's a case called kviya hezeka, where the Gemara says when things are kviya hezeka, particularly dangerous, then you can suffer even if you're a tzaddik, right? Or even if you did a mitzvah, or the workings of a hereditary curse. We might add to these mechanisms certain rules that might not violate Maimonides' assumptions, such as the sliding scale of judgment applied to the persons depending on their righteousness, right? He said, right, at some level, that's right. That's a hard idea, right? The idea that tzaddikim are judged kechod hasara, right? Tzaddikim are judged more strictly. But that's not fair. Yeah. We're not fully fair. It doesn't feel fair, right? Either because of their responsibilities, moral leaders of their generation, to whatever geographical or social extent their influence carries, or to the inordinately severe punishment meted out for certain sins, as noted above. Though here he might well have interpreted these assertions as overstatements intended to impress our hearts. Fine. We might add to these the rules, the consequences of being a member of the community. Right? He said another thing is that Chazal assumed that you can be punished as part of a community, right? Community of Israel. And, right, what about when the Gemara says that Misha nitna koech lamashchet, right, once the power is given to the mashchet to destroy, right, he doesn't distinguish between righteous and evil, right? Right, who, right, they couldn't have harmed the very Israelites who Exodus from Egypt was sent to facilitate, right? That's how Chazal understands why the Jews had to lock themselves inside during Makkah Bechara. God's hiding of his face, right, Hester Panim, during exile, or the necessity of God's plan for history, which at times sweeps away those who resist it, as, what is the Gemara saying, Tanit Daf Hei, right, that, right, Shmuel didn't want to anoint David, because he knew that, Ein Melech Nogea Bim, right, B'Malchut Chaveiro, that, right, it could be that once he made David king, right, that leads to the end of Shaul, right, just because they can't both be king. Right, to some extent, the elements in this list of non-measure for measure misfortune do not overlap. Some apply to individuals, some to the community, some to individuals who are in particular positions of responsibility. But the demarcation of the various elements that apply to individuals of the intermediate class, Banonim and Ravis terminology, such as Kfiyah Hazekah or Mazal, or the workings of hereditary curse. However, we might assume in most cases that whatever the intermediary source, astrology, hereditary curse, etc., the actual mechanism for its fulfillment is to be found in the hazards of everyday life. Right? So, again, I think that this is a very important point, right? That, again, the Rishonim, definitely, especially someone like the Rambam, really tries to minimize the number of cases in suffering where you can't point to it and say, this is fair, this is measure for measure. And, again, maybe in the end, right, in the end of the day, everything will be fair. That's not necessarily the point, right? But the point is that a fair read of the Gemara leads you to the possibility that not every voice in Chazal is committed to a one-to-one correspondence theory of suffering, right? At the very minimal level. Right, again, that doesn't mean it's not going to be fair in the long term. But the fact that the Gemara seems to recognize a certain amount of mazal, a certain amount of nature, the idea that God can be angry, and then people will suffer then. Or Kfiyah Hazekah, if a situation is dangerous, then even if you're righteous, you might, right, you might die anyways. The fact that the Gemara talks about that once the koach is given to the mashchit, right, everyone gets destroyed. The only thing you can do is lock yourself in a room. That when there is a plague, right, just quarantine yourself and there's nothing you can do, right? And doesn't say in every case, daven, and it'll be fine, right? Do mitzvah and it'll be fine. Right, and has all these advices. Listen, sometimes things are dangerous, and if you don't take practical measures, you're going to get hurt. Right, at some level, the Gemara is saying, listen, it might be true, but a super detailed theology where you look at every single thing, which again, is that how the Gemara introduces our Gemara? Yes, right? If you're suffering, it's an Aveira. If it's not an Aveira, Bittel Torah. But then, by the third line, the Gemara says, or maybe Yisur Shalava. Oh, maybe Serge Lava. What is that? So simple shot. It's not sin, right? And then as we saw, Ham and Bet, the Gemara says, for all of it, right, for all its talk of highfalutin theology, the Gemara says, do you want this? Lohan and Loskarn, just get me out of here, right? And again, all the Gemara is about it, God being angry, that, right? You put it together, a very, right? It is compelling to realize that at least, again, is this the majority view? I don't know what's the majority view. Is there definitely a view that emerges from, right, to many places in the Gemara? What he calls later, right, the bookkeeping problem, right? That many places in the Gemara just assume that, there is a bookkeeping problem, right? Meaning you're not going to be able to consistently look at every sin and point in every single, not, again, even Rava, as he notes, who in many places says, right, be careful. Even Rava, what does he do? He says the first thing you do is try to figure out is this measure for measure. Right? He's not rejecting it. He's not saying that that's not part or even a big part. Maybe he's not even denying that it's the primary part of the story. Right? And therefore, obviously, the first thing you're supposed to do if you're suffering is figure out what did you do to deserve it. Right? Now, again, is that because Rava definitively says, and this was a point right, Karmi made to me years ago, right? Is it clear in the Gemara that Rava, and Rubenstein makes it here as well, is it clear that Rava believes that the reason you're supposed to look for what sin might have caused it is because he really believes that that's really why it happened? Or is he saying every opportunity to motivate yourself to do tshuva should be taken? And therefore, even if you get it wrong, right? Right? Meaning if you get a cold sore, right? On your tongue, right? In your mouth, right? And in Shamayim, the reason that you got the cold sore was because you... You davened without kavana, right? Right? So your mouth was moving, right? Without thinking, right? So God hit you in your mouth, right? And you sit down and you think about it and you say, oh, why would I get a cold sore? And you say, oh, right, it might be because it's Lashon Hara, right? So, and then you work on yourself and you do tshuva and you're better about Lashon Hara. So is that a, right? Right. So is that a failure? So it depends. If you think that what Rava is really saying is the first thing you're supposed to do is try to really figure out, it's measure for measure, right? So then at some level you failed. Yeah. Right, but if he's saying, listen, you're supposed to take the opportunity every time you're suffering to try to think about what this might happen because it'll motivate you to do tshuva and it'll improve you, and maybe you'll get it right, maybe you'll get it wrong, but this is more of a religious posture rather than it's a success. Right, so even though it's true, Rava starts off by saying, look for the measure for measure, it's not clear that he's committed to it. Right, he could just be saying, because the proper religious response to suffering ideally is tshuva. Right, but so it's not that even Rava, let's say, denies the fact that mida keneged mida and reward and punishment is a part of this story, right? The question is it the whole story, right? And that's like when you get to the line, right? Yisurin shel ahava. So what do you do with it, right? If you're committed to an idea that everything is always fair in a very predictable, rational way, so yisurin shel ahava creates a lot of problems because the simple pshat of the Gemara is. Yisurin shel ahava is not that. It's if you can't figure out what you did wrong. And even when you take Bittul Torah into account, you can't figure out what you did wrong. So then it's Yisurin shel ahava. Right? Again, Rashi reads the Sugya and he says, yeah, Yisurin shel ahava means that God sometimes just says, here, I'll give you extra points, right? If I smack, for every time I smack you, I'll give you $5. Okay? Let me smack you. Boom, 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 right here. Right? Here's a bonus. Right? Right? The way Rashi reads the Gemara, pshat is listen. Much of suffering is really me to kind of get me, but not all of it, right? Even though the Rambam pushes back on that Gemara, and the Ramban pushes back on that read of the Gemara. A very simple read of the Gemara, and a traditional read, right, from Rashi, is that, yeah, Rava obviously incorporates me to kind of get me into much of his theological thinking about suffering, but it's not the full story, right? And what Elman points out is that this isn't, if it was one Gemara, so you would say, okay, fine. Rashi says that, but it's one Gemara. Maybe the Rambam's really right. Maybe the Ramban's really right. We can come up with one that really explains me the connected Mida. But when you have 20 Gemaras, right, that introduce all these factors of, well, your schar will help you unless it's a kviya hezeka, it's a dangerous time, or the mashchit is out, or there's a plague, right? And what you should be doing is closing your window, right? How many Gemaras do you need to have until you say, you know what? Rashi's not crazy. Right, maybe the Gemara really does at least have certain voices who say, listen, not everything in the world can be reduced in a one-to-one correspondence of Mida Keneged Mida. Again, is that denying the fact that in the big picture that it's all going to work out? No, right? Rashi clearly thinks it'll work out. Right? That's Rashi's whole point. Surin Shalava means that sometimes God will give you extra reward for punishment. Right? He'll work it out somehow in the end of days. Right? In Olam Haba. You can say that. That doesn't change the fact that in the here and now, this is not yet fair. Right? God, saying that God will make it fair in the world to come is not saying it is fair in the here and now. Those are not the same. Right? And therefore, and it's very important to as much, because again, part of us, I think, pushes against this. Right? Because we're, you know, my mind is, right? Yes. Right? But So the two points I wanted to make today, right? So I basically wanted to make two points that for me are very connected conceptually, right? One is Rubinstein's read of the second half of our Gemara, which is that the Gemara itself questions the importance, or at least the primacy of theology, right? Is that after introducing theology, the Gemara says it's all true, it's all nice, but the response to suffering often is just be there with the person, cry with them. And sometimes people don't care about all the theology and all the schar they may be getting, just get them out of there, right? So the first point is that, yes, theology is important, but it's often not what people need or are willing to hear in the moment, right? Point two, which is Elman's point, is that even on the level of theology, there is a good reason to believe that within the Gemara's understanding, even if things are going to work out in the long term, the Gemara is very open to the possibility that not every single thing is fair. That, again, does that mean that God and Olam Haba will make it up to you? Maybe. That's what Rashi thinks Yisur and Shalava is. That doesn't change the fact that when someone screams because they're suffering, it's not fair. According to Rashi, they might be right. Right? According to Rashi, they might be right. When someone says it's not fair, it's like Eov. Right? That when Eov says it's not fair, the answer is, if you actually have read the book, the answer is yes, because he's suffering because the Satan wanted to make a point. Right? It's not fair. It's not fair. Right? And according to Rashi, saying that in Olam Haba, God will give you extra reward because he slapped you a bunch of times in this world, that doesn't mean it's fair. It just means that one day God will make it up to you. Right? But saying something like that, or saying that that schar mitzvah b'hayah amaleka, that God doesn't reward you for mitzvah in this world, means that you can be a really good person in this world, and you'll suffer, right? And that was the point of that Gemara. That look, here are two Tamidei Chachamim. They're equal Tamidei Chachamim. They're both involved in Chesed. They're both, right? And one's poor, one's rich. One lives a long life, one lives a short life. One is, right, is always celebrating, and one is always losing children, right? The Gemara clearly thinks they're equivalent religiously, that maybe in Olam Haba they'll both be on pedestals, right? But in this world, the Gemara is saying, but it's not fair, right? And what things like Yisur and Shalava and Kfiyah Zeka and Nidan Ritcha, all that says is, yes, in this world, because of the complexity of the power of nature, right? The power of mazal, whatever that means, right? The power of the incommensurability of this world with true schar, right? The fact that this world just isn't really the place for schar v'onesh to play out, because the spiritual world and the physical world just don't mix, right? All those come together to tell you that in this world, it's just not cut out for a perfect correspondence of suffering and punishment. It's just not. And again, are there Rishonim pushback? Obviously, we'll see. The Rambam push back on this a lot, right? Not 100%, but they push back.
Yeah.
But for sure, right? But the point is that there's at least a plausible read of the Gemara, which is accepted by major Rishonim, like Rashi right here in Yisur and Shalava, who says, again, in the long term, God will make it fair, but that doesn't mean it's fair now, right? Doesn't mean it's fair, right? You think about it, right? To put it differently, right? I'll end with this, right? If someone says, listen, right, how many people have you told them, you were hurt, you were assaulted, you were whatever, you were, right? You were, I don't know, you were unfairly fired. I don't care if it's monetary, physical, right? And then you told them, don't worry, you will win a lawsuit in 5 years and you'll get $2 million, right? People will say, well, that's punitive, right? They're saying it's still not fair, right? It's not like it makes it fair, right? It means that God will, that the courts will make it up to you, and maybe they'll make it up to you more, and it'll be punitive, and you'll, right? And you'll end up being rich. But that doesn't mean that, right? That doesn't make it fair. It just means that you're going to try to make it up later. That doesn't mean it's fair. Right? Saying Yisur and Shalava means that God will make it up to you in the world to come doesn't mean it's fair. It just means that God will make it up to you. Right? But it's a very different theology. Right? So again, the two points I wanted to make. First half is that theology is insufficient. Right? Often for people in the real life's experience. That's Rubinstein on the second half of the Gemara. And then Elman's point, which is, and even theologically, much of the Gemara points in the direction that even if it's fair in the big picture, it is true that in the moment, right, not everything is fair, and not everything is, right, reward, punishment, one-to-one correspondence. Right? And therefore, it's not just that emotionally, it might be the wrong thing to start be explaining to people why this is really fair and why it's all for the best. It also might not be true. Right? It might actually not be true. It might be that, no, in the here and now, this is just unfair. Right? And therefore, when people say, I'm not comforted by it, they might be right. Right? Like, not just emotionally, but theologically, which is, listen, I experience it as unfair, and the answer might be, yeah, it is unfair. Okay? Those are the two points that I wanted to make today, which, again, I think they're connected points, even though one is on the theological plane, one's on the emotional one, but I think that idea of not looking for perfection theologically, right, is important. Yeah. Take it, and then we'll...
First of all, the opinion that, like, you get rewarded later on for punishment you get now, isn't that the view of the group of Muslims that the Rambam
yes.
ultimately criticizes?
Correct. Yes, exactly. Rashi's view is equivalent to some of the Muslim views the Rambam says are obviously wrong. Right. Yeah, that's not... Okay. What else is new? Yeah?
So now that we have... according to Yaakov Ellman, in the here and now, it's not fair. So how do we cope with that, necessarily?
Well, that goes back to the first half of this year, how do you cope with that? Again, you can't necessarily, but part of it is to recognize that, yeah, you don't necessarily cope with it with theology. Right? That was Rubenstein's point, is that the answer might not be theology, right? Right? The answer might not be theology. Yeah.
So in regards to how it's not fair because you can't even if you get reward in the world to come, it's not necessarily it doesn't make it fair. That just means God's making up to you.
Right.
So isn't that the same thing for Isurim that are atoning for sins because sins are something that you're punished for in the next world anyways?
Yeah. I mean, right. You'd have to right. It could be in its other cases as well. Right. Which is when God punishes you here. Is that really the full punishment, or is that like?
So does that mean that all Isurim are essentially just unfair?
I mean, at some level, right, you might argue that, right? You might, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be that the Gemara goes in that direction. It does seem to be open to the possibility that at least some is fair, and, you know.
So what's the distinction?
That's a good question, right? We can try to come back to it. Again, I should just have this disclaimer, which is this is such a big topic that we can't cover everything. What I'm trying to do, right, last week I tried to do an introduction to the theological issue, and this week I wanted to, right, introduce you to the limits of theology, right, both in the emotional level and then within the theological issue itself, right? I can't do every Gemara and every Parish and every everything, right? What I'm trying to do is give you certain tools and certain ideas that will help you read through these Gemaras, right? I can't give you everything, right? Meaning...
What's next step? Are we exploring the emotional side of it now?
No, we did the emotional. I think what I'll do is try... I might here follow a bit from Rabbi Dr. Aaron Siegel, who gave a four-part series on Edrisha last year, where he laid out three of the central theological approaches that you find in secular thinkers and Christian thinkers and Jewish thinkers.
As to what the purpose
of suffering is, right? And then showing how some of, right, certain pieces of evidence from each of these. So we might do... So we'll go through it. It's already 9:42, so I think we'll end there, okay?